Do you enjoy improv comedy? I kind of like it, and I've had a chance to do it once or twice with mixed success. But could you imagine taking an improv class to get better at a serious job, like being a doctor or a nurse? The UW School of Medicine and Public Health offers an improv class, and we're going to talk about that with the associate professor who teaches it, and her name, Amy Zielinski, a medical education researcher, associate professor of medicine in the UW School of Medicine. It's great to have Amy Zielinski with us. Amy, welcome, by the way.
Thank you so much. It's wonderful to be here with you, Larry.
Oh, man. It's great to have you here. And as you listen to Amy, I hope you'll join in. Maybe you've received some training to improve your interpersonal skills at work. Would you like to take an improv class to learn how to maybe have more empathy toward other people? I think that's part of the goal here. Give a call. The number 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. How did you come, Amy, to teach a class on improvisational theater for students pursuing a degree in healthcare?
Yeah, so I really started my career working with medical residents, and we were teaching them how to deliver difficult news. So a patient has a new cancer diagnosis, or unfortunately, they have a recurrence. And as I was working with these residents, I realized that they could perform as we would want them to. They could say the words, but they really were struggling with the connection piece. And they really cared so deeply about their patients, but they felt like if they cared too much, they would no longer be an effective physician. And so I started to understand this as empathy, as a skill that most of us have. But when you go into a profession where you're faced with a lot of suffering, you have to learn how to flex it, how to use it a little bit more intentionally. And I'm a former actor, and I realized that I learned those skills through acting. So that kind of led me down the path to think, how could I use theater and improv as the most accessible form of theater to help folks learn these skills?
Because you were teaching students about this, but you hadn't started out. You just thought, suddenly, why not an improv class?
Yeah. And luckily, there was a woman named Katie Watson at Northwestern who was doing this before me. And So I was able to go and learn from her, and Belinda Fu, who's at Washington State. And I also had some support from a student who came to me and said, you know, I think people are doing this around the country. Maybe we could do it here. And then Liz Petty, who's our associate dean over at the medical school, was also very supportive. So I had support from all ends. And I said, hey, let's try this out.
So how does improv help students develop empathy?
So the core tenets of improv, so we think about improv, like you mentioned, we think about it as comedy sports or Second City. Its roots are actually from the Hull House in Chicago. So Jane Addams hired a social worker named Neva Boyd to work with children at the Hull House. And Neva started using these techniques to get children to relate to each other, to work together, to hear each other. And Viola Spolin took those from the Hull House, those activities, to the theater, and that's what we call improv. So at its core, improv is really about connection, about listening, about really listening and not just thinking about what we're going to say next, which I think is really difficult for us.
Yeah. And I think empathy is defined as the imaginative reconstruction of another's perspective and the emotional resonance this causes in the self.
Yeah. So I think sometimes we think about it as putting ourselves in other shoes, but I think that's limiting. Because really, in order for me to understand your experience, I need to imagine what it might be like to be you. And it might be very different from my own experience.
So these classes, it's improv. But there must be, are there topics that are, you know, sort of drummed up or that you have thought through in advance that you... do with the students, or how do you do it?
So the first class is really kind of foundational. So there are certain rules of improv. Like many people have probably heard the rule of saying yes and. So we go through those rules. We practice doing that. We practice not asking questions. I know that for an interviewer, that's probably a hard rule to think about. Mm-hmm. One of the rules is to try to not ask questions. And then as we go further in the class, we focus on verbal communication, nonverbal communication, and can we kind of parse it out that way? Because as a course, you want to make sure that folks are taking things away and learning specific content. But what we create in the class is purely improvised. It exists for that moment and is gone forever.
So it's not necessarily a health topic that somebody throws out, or is it? So anybody in the class throws out an idea?
Yeah, exactly. And sometimes it's health related and sometimes it's not. We kind of just go with it. We say yes and.
Well, and. Oh, man. So, and you've done some research on this, too.
Yeah, exactly. So thinking about, you know, part of what I enjoy about being in academia is the ability to ask research questions. And when I started to see learners really learn from these activities, I wanted to know how and why and what it was that they were learning. So we started to do some research. My research focus is on empathy and communication in healthcare. So I really focused on those domains. And we found that after a 6-week course, students were able to increase their empathic abilities, which unfortunately, when folks come into medicine, they tend to be really high in empathy. And then as they go through training, that declines. So I was interested in finding ways that we could keep that higher and learn, help them learn how to manage that empathy in this new setting. And improv seems to be a really valuable tool.
So I noticed that research that empathy goes down the longer you're in the learning to become a doctor or physician. And why?
Yeah. There's a lot of different ideas about why that might be. I, as a medical educator, take some responsibility for that. I think we have our students and our residents focusing so much on the medical knowledge, on the patient care, which is very important. But then sometimes my students in my class will say, you know, I've forgotten who I am. I am all of a sudden becoming this physician, but I've lost so many parts of myself. And I think that we can't ask people to engage in empathy with others if they're not really help fully themselves and can be authentic with those patients.
Yeah, and I was thinking about the structure of medicine these days is much different than it probably was when I was a kid. Let's put it that way.
Yeah.
My Dr. Schoenbeck would sit down and talk to me about all kinds of things. And I have a great doctor now, Jim Sossman, and he'll take the time because we've kind of been together for like 30 years.
Yeah.
It's a lot of lots of conversations that he and I have had over time. But I even see it in him. Or other doctors, actually, there's a lot of paperwork.
There's
a lot of need to, I think, to move patients along.
Yeah, the system is overrun. I mean, we have a lot of patients and not much time to spend with them. So they have a lot of pressures on them. Technology has made our lives so much better in so many ways. But with the electronic medical record, there's a lot more demands on their time. A lot of things that take them away from those conversations that they really love having with their patients.
Yeah. Amy Zielinski, our guest today, medical education researcher and associate professor of medicine at UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Questions for her, or maybe an experience to share. That'd be cool, too, if you've got one that was good or maybe not good. I hope you'll join in. The number 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or email to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. How difficult is it for healthcare students to learn to listen to their patients?
I think some of it is about unlearning. So trying to sort of take all of those things that they've learned and these question sets that they know that they need to ask in order to make a diagnosis, know that they've got that, and then start to work on this other skill of really just being present with the patient and that and have the confidence that they're going to ask that next question even after they listen to their patient with real intention.
Yeah, that's hard to do sometimes, I think.
Yeah.
I'm in the business, here we're in the business of talking with people and interviewing them for shows, and sometimes I'll even find myself thinking about the next question I'm going to ask rather than listening to what the person is telling me.
Yeah, and so
And I've been doing it a while.
Right. So when you're in an improv scene in front of other people, that's a real liability because you realize, oh, no, I'm stuck. I did not listen to what my partner was telling me. So I need to do better and really engage and really listen to my partner. Because improv, at the heart of it, is really about making your partner look good. It's not necessarily about yourself. So if you're not listening to them and really adding to the contributions that they're providing, then you're not successful. You're not doing your job. And you feel that. And so some of that, like your last guest was saying, you know, being able to recover from setbacks in an improv class, you have many, many setbacks in a two-hour class. And so it's a great opportunity to build that resilience.
Yeah, I imagine there are many. How does it really go? I mean, by the end, are people much more accomplished than they... I mean, it's got to be probably a range of abilities to begin with.
Yeah, absolutely. But I would say we meet 6 weeks, by the third class, people are really hitting their stride. Even the folks that were very hesitant to come to class, to take the class, they're really starting to get into it, to listen, to feel successful, to know that they're going to have something to contribute at the end. Even when they're listening to their partner, they can have that confidence that they're going to be successful in that situation. And then they bring back stories from how they've used this in their real life as well.
Oh, so that it works in other places too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we were talking earlier about, I just mentioned in passing, I think, interviewing for jobs. And I thought... In your research, there was some feedback on that.
Yeah. Medical students in their fourth year of medical school are interviewing for residency positions. So many students who were in my class last fall mentioned how helpful it was in their interviews to have this idea of yes and to just build on what their interviewers were asking them to keep the conversation going. And it really helped them build confidence and appear confident to their interviewers as well.
So somebody said, what's this yes and business I'm getting here? And
yeah.
go ahead and explain that a bit more.
So often when we're in a conversation, maybe not often, but sometimes when we're in a conversation, we're going back and forth and we're using maybe a yes, but. So we're having a conversation and I agree with you a little bit, but I want you to hear this other point of view. And sometimes we're arguing and that answer is no. So we're arguing back and forth. So in improv, we have to build this yes and muscle. So whatever you contribute, whatever you say, I'm going to say yes and. So I'm going to agree and I'm going to offer something of my own as well.
I I'm not going to name any names here, but I once worked with a guy who was involved in some UW things, and there was going to be a meeting. And he said, well, here's what I'd like, how I'd like this meeting, this point, and this point passed. And it was a group of people who were not happy about a lot of things. And I watched him in action because he came in and people immediately started to complain. And he said, I'm with you on this. This is... the issue, and he's agreeing with them, and then we went on to other things, and then in the end, the 3 points that he wanted to get across and have action in his favor were all happily approved by everybody there. I saw him do that sort of thing more than once, and it was a real really cool skill to have.
Yeah, absolutely. We walk into rooms and, you know, you can imagine clinicians walk into rooms all the time where people are upset. They've been waiting. They're, you know, not, they don't want to be there in the first place. So having this ability to take that on and transform it into something positive is really, really helpful.
Yeah. Tim and Madison, what's on your mind?
Hey, good afternoon. So I wanted to ask you about empathy, nonverbal communication based on people's behavior and their fitness when they come in for a medical exam. So, for instance, people get vital signs taken and they're sitting in a chair and they often don't move out of the chair at all, or they just move over to a table. But what about looking at having them walk and checking their gait, or doing simple fitness tests like grip strength or the sit stand from a chair? So my question is, how are physicians learning to be empathetic based on observations of movement?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think in my class and in what I teach, we often will talk about just making sure that you're meeting the patient where they are. And in order to know where they are, you have to have some data. And so if that data that's important is how they're moving around, then absolutely getting in there, doing these different techniques and exams, really relating to them physically. I think there's so much that we can find out, like you're saying, with blood tests or from the medical record, but we really still need to know each other and how their bodies are working. So I think that's a really important point.
And as Tim started to talk, I was thinking about it from totally the other end. The other extreme is that you're I'm the doctor. And so my own nonverbal communication, talk about that a bit. Is that part of the course?
Yeah. And I think one of the interesting things about improv is that it brings out things that are our habits that we might not even be aware of. So we have interactions in the class, and then we can kind of take them apart and debrief about them. And what was that like? And what did you notice? And what did the audience notice? And people can start to realize how they're coming across nonverbally to other people as well, which is a huge part of empathy, because that's how we're being seen by the other person. So we need to be aware of that.
And looking people in the eye and...
Very important. There's cultural differences with eye contact. Yeah. But so, you know, we talk about that a lot in class and how to navigate that. But I think in our culture, for, you know, generally, that's something that we practice and talk about.
Are there other professions that could benefit from improv, you think?
I think so. I think so. And it's been used in a lot of different professions in the business world and at the law school. I know that they're doing some things. So I think that a lot of other professions are starting to catch on. Social work, it grew up in social work, and folks in social work still use it, or counseling. And I think just in daily life, sometimes my students will tell me, you know, these skills helped me have a better conversation with my brother who I haven't talked to in a while. So I think they're just very transferable skills.
And you've heard some feedback from former students. I'm wondering, and you mentioned some non-medical, I think, instances, but what about students sharing their experiences based on practicing with patients?
Yeah, I think one of the things that comes across is this ability to show up and to have confidence in your ability to help people. So unfortunately, some of our physicians, you know, they're with people at the end of life when they don't have any more medical answers or treatments for them. And they come back to me and say, you know, doing some of the improv or helping me build those skills helped me be present with them and realize that my presence and my ability to be there with them was therapeutic and was what I could offer in the moment, which is really hard for physicians because, you know, they want to make people better, and sometimes
that's not going to happen. And I've had I've had both ends of that spectrum in my own life over time, where I had a very sort of offhand remark about the death of the coming death of a child, and then I had on the other end of that a doctor who sat down with us and was really empathetic, and thankfully undid a lot of what the first person caused in the way of grief and so forth.
Well, thank you for sharing that example. I think it's so important. I think sometimes we think of empathy and communication as additional skills that clinicians need to know, but that's an example of how you can do harm with your communication, and so I think it's essential.
Well, I am glad you're teaching this class because I think I wish every med student had to take it, to be perfectly honest. Oh my gosh, it's been really enlightening and fun, Amy. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Larry. It's been a joy to be here.
Amy Zielinski, a medical education researcher and associate professor of medicine at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. And coming up, we're going to continue with our medical. And we're talking with a doctor who sometimes probably has to give some advice that he doesn't want to give relating to pancreatic cancer. That'll be next. We'll take a look at pancreatic cancer with our guest, Dr. Jeremy Kratz. I'm Larry Mueller.